this is the workshop, the G8, War and Resistance. My name's Blake. I'm from Montreal. I'm from the CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence in Montreal. We're mobilizing for a demonstration against the G8 in Ottawa. Ottawa is the capital of Canada. What happened is the G8 is the group of the eight big, rich, powerful countries in the world right now. And what happened is they were going to have a meeting in Ottawa. But after the meetings last year in Genoa, in which there were 300,000 people there, massive police violence, and there was even one protester killed, which is, you know, kind of a new thing for these northern anti-globalization protests, although not necessarily for the anti-globalization protests in the south. After that, Chrétien, the Prime Minister of Canada, decided they were going to retreat to the hills of Alberta. And Alberta is kind of north of Montana for your geographic reference there. So basically, they're going way off into the middle of nowhere to a little resort town, a little skiing resort, where they can, as Jean Chrétien said, where leaders can be leaders away from all the protests. So what the CLAC and a number of other groups, including ACCA, the Anti-Capitalist Community Action in Ottawa, and various other groups, are calling for is a regional mobilization in Ottawa. And I'll talk a bit about that afterwards, and I have some information on that I'll hand out at the end. But I'm going to give more of a presentation right now on what is the G8 and try to put the G8 in context, both a bit of historical context and also just context with the other big international institutions that it's involved in and all of that. So what is the G8? The G8 is made up of the following countries: the United States, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, Canada, and Russia. The reason Russia is there's a space between all these other countries and Russia is because the G8 should really more accurately be called the G7/G8. Because while all these countries here are the big, rich, industrialized countries, Russia's has a lot of political power, but its economy is shit. So what happens is the G7 and the G8, they meet, and they're basically one organization that exists, sort of has two parallel parts. When they're talking about important financial matters, the G7 will meet. So like the financial ministers, when they meet, it's just the G7. They don't care about Russia. But then when it's larger, more important geopolitical things, then Russia's involved. So the G8 is not like, it's not like a lot of the other big international institutions that we have been like protesting against. It's not like the IMF and the World Bank, in that it doesn't have a huge paid staff that does things all year round. Basically, what it does is it has a summit once a year where all the heads of state from all the G8 countries come and they talk to each other. They get to work out sort of in informal settings. They get to work out sort of a general consensus about what they want to be doing. The G8 doesn't have specific powers that it does. It doesn't have like specific control over other organizations, but because of the power that's represented in the G8 countries, the other international institutions can't really do much without the blessing of the G8. So we've been calling it in our mobilization campaign for Ottawa, we've been calling it the executive board of global capitalism. So the G8 nations make up 10% of the population of the world, but they have 48% of the global economy and 49% of international trade. In the World Bank, they control 45% of the vote, and in the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, they control 48% of the vote. And of course, the U.S. controls 17% of the vote in both the IMF and the World Bank, so it can veto anything by itself. So the way the G8 works is it interlocks with these other big institutions and will do co-sponsor various things, or you know some IMF managing director will come to a G8 summit and give a presentation and try to get various G8 leaders to get involved in IMF things and vice versa, but it's very informal. The G8 started in the first meeting, it was the G6 then, was in 1975. And it started sort of at the same time as a lot of the neoliberal policies that we're seeing now were really getting concretized. In 1971 was when the U.S. took the dollar off the gold standard, and in 1973 was the OPEC oil embargo, which led to like all this messing over of the global economy, and so the G8 or the G6 back then came about as sort of a response to that and a need to coordinate policies at the highest level amongst the richest, most powerful countries. The interesting thing to remember about the G8 countries also is that they became the richest, most powerful countries in the world because of a long history of domination of the rest of the world. Like, these countries here are, with no exceptions, I don't think, that have been historically very powerful, and they've been the ones that have benefited from various slavery and from colonialism and from hundreds of years of capitalist development. So this year, the G8 in their meetings in Kananaskis, Alberta, they have three things on the agenda that they're going to mainly talk about. The first is a new partnership for African development. The second is economic growth, and the third is the war on terrorism. So I'm just going to talk about slash trash each of these agenda items. So the first agenda item they have is the new partnership for African development, NEPAD, as it's called. It's this big, nice document about how they're going to develop Africa and help the poor, starving African people. It's interesting because it starts off. It was proposed by Thabo Mbeki, who's the president of South Africa, and it has a lot of rhetoric in it about how Africa's been kept down under the boot of colonialism and imperialism for a long time, and it's time for a new partnership with Africa and on equal terms, so that Africans can take control of their own destiny and bring themselves out of poverty. And it has a lot of statistics about African poverty and things like that. It also has a bit of a history in that there were various other proposals before the NEPAD, such as the one directly previous to the new partnership for African development was the New African Initiative, which was also proposed by Thabo Mbeki, president of South Africa. But they changed it because the New African Initiative, NAI, in Afrikaan, NAI means to be fucked over. So amongst other reasons, but that was one of the reasons that they changed it. So what's wrong with this? I mean, first of all, it's not, as it's presented, it's not actually been created in consultation with, like, the people of Africa. It was, a few African elites going to Genoa, the summit last year, and, developing it with the G8 states. And it's really, like, the G8 can say that they can use this to say, oh, you silly anti-globalization protesters, go back home. We're actually listening to Africa. We're listening to the voice of Africa. But really, it's being created at the G8 and by African elites for African elites, right? And for Western elites, of course. And also, despite all the rhetoric in it about Africans taking control of their own destiny and all this sort of thing, it actually has all the exact same policies that have been imposed on Africa for the past, however long. More privatization, more neoliberal policies generally, more market access, all this sort of thing. So, but more important than me analyzing this document in any kind of depth is to look at what activists in South Africa, for example, are saying. So, I have a quote here from a guy named Trevor Ngawe, who has been researching NEPAD and these sorts of things, and he says, and he's talking about the relationship between Africa and Western Europe generally. And he says, he describes it as a partnership between rider and horse, and says, the relationship between Africa and Western Europe has been one between colonizer and colonized, exploiter and exploited. While the exact terms of this predatory relationship have evolved over time, it seems foolhardy for Mbeki and company to ask for partnership with people who still benefit from Africa's wealth at the expense of the African people. Imperialism is the problem. A partnership with it cannot be a solution. And of course, the other thing to note about NEPAD is that NEPAD calls for a certain amount of aid to Africa and all this sort of thing. So it's actually likely that NEPAD itself won't even be accepted, and the G8's going to endorse its own Africa Action Plan, because why would they give aid to exploit a continent that they're already exploiting? So chances are they won't even be approving NEPAD. So that's so much for the Africa agenda item. The other two agenda items are economic growth and the war on terrorism. So economic growth I'm not going to talk about too much because I think I don't really need to sort of attack the whole idea of neoliberal economic growth. That's a lot of what people in sort of anti-globalization, anti-capitalist circles have been talking about for a long time. I just want to highlight a few things. So people like, say, George Bush, when he was the governor of Texas, he'd say things like, NAFTA is good for Texas and good for Mexico. But the important thing to remember is that when we're talking about states that are getting involved in free trade agreements or various other like multilateral, like big international institutions, you have to remember that these states are not homogenous. Not everybody's equal within these states. So both the United States and Mexico are extremely class stratified. There's rich people and there's poor people. There's privileged races and there's underprivileged races, historically and currently oppressed races. And all these things intersect with like class and race and gender oppressions. And the way this kind of capitalist development works is that it continues to privilege elite classes against the classes that have been attacked for hundreds of years. So just to give you an example of how this plays itself out, some of you may have heard this. This is a memo from Lawrence Summers, who is the World Bank's chief economist a while ago. He's now the president of Harvard. And it's an internal memo that he wrote in 1991. He says, just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the LDCs, that's lesser developed countries? The measurements of the cost of health-impairing pollution depend on the foregone earnings from increased morbidity and mortality. From this point of view, a given amount of health-impairing pollution should be done in the country with the lowest cost, which will be the country with the lowest wages. I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. So it's a matter of the actual logic of the kind of development that's being pushed. It makes perfect sense under capitalist development to screw over poor people so that you can make more money, to dump toxic waste on people who make less money because it hurts the economy less because their wages cost less. And you see this sort of, it's important to look at this kind of capitalist development through a class analysis whenever you're looking at these various things. So when you have NAFTA, the GDP of the various countries grows, which is great for investors, it's great for big corporations, but it's bad for poor people, both in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Wages dropped in all countries. Standard of living generally dropped in all the countries. And in Mexico especially, 2 million Mexican campesinos were forced off their land, outcompeted by big corporations. And then, of course, these Mexican campesinos, who are mostly indigenous people, have to go straight to work in the new foreign-owned factories, the maquiladoras. And the same thing with a number of these sorts of policies, privatization policies. They benefit the rich people who own the corporations, who are getting all the subsidies and who can then jack up the prices of whatever is being privatized. But the people who are having their, say, water prices go up, which is the poor people who can't pay for them, are getting screwed over. So just to say, give you one statistic on since the G8's been around since 1975, and been meeting somewhat informally before that. I just want to throw out a statistic to show you sort of how this this class divide has been playing out over this time. So in 1960, the richest one-fifth of the world's population had 30 times more wealth than the poorest one-fifth. That was in 1960. In 1997, they had 74 times more wealth. So as you can see, this capitalist development has been doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's been making rich people richer at the expense of poor people. So the G8 and various big other institutions of the ruling class have been, they've been under a certain amount of pressure to change these policies. And whenever they're talking about growth and economic growth and this sort of thing, there's usually some sort of talk about poverty reduction now. There's usually a bit of rhetoric thrown in about that sort of thing. But I have a quote here about exactly how the G8 leaders expect to achieve this kind of poverty reduction. They say, and this is from their communique after the Genoa summit last year, and they say, "The situation in many developing countries, especially in Africa, calls for decisive global action. The most effective poverty reduction strategy is to maintain a strong, dynamic, open, and growing global economy. We pledge to do that." So in other words, they pledge to do exactly the same thing they've been doing for the past, at least past 30 years, and, you know, it has historical links to the past 500 years. And that's how they're going to get rid of poverty, by screwing over poor people. So there's so much for the economic growth aspect of this. And the third agenda item that the G8 has on its agenda this year is the war on terrorism. When people are being made poor by the policies, by this sort of neoliberal capitalist policies, they fight back. And that's a lot of what the war on terrorism is about. I mean, today is May Day, right? And I think a lot of people probably know what May Day is, but I'm just gonna go really quick. There was May Day in Chicago in 1886. There was a call to have strikes on May 1st in support of the 8-hour day, because the working conditions were absolutely horrible. People were child labor. People were working 16-hour days, that sort of thing. And these demonstrations were, there was a certain amount of police violence at these demonstrations. So later on, there was another demonstration called to denounce the police violence. And that one was attacked by police, and there was a bomb thrown, and some police were killed. And eventually what happened was a lot of the anarchist organizers who had been working on this campaign were framed and killed. So ever since then, it's been, a workers' holiday and a holiday of, struggle of working people. Except in the United States, where it's not officially recognized, and it's actually Law Day. In Reagan, in the 80s, designated May 1st as Law Day, in celebration of the 200-year-old partnership of law and liberty, and he goes on, to say, without which we would fall into chaos and anarchy. So he declared this in so that May Day or Law Day would be May 1st, 1984. Another interesting thing that happened on May 1st, 1984, was that Nicaragua, the country of Nicaragua, filed a suit against the United States, basically accusing them of international terrorism. What happened was Nicaragua had been under a brutal dictatorship, Somoza, that had been backed by the United States, Israel, various other big nasty countries. And eventually there was a revolution, the Sandinista Revolution in 1978-79. It was like a sort of civil war into a revolution. And the United States spent a massive amount of money funding counter-revolutionary forces, the Contras, to wage a major war in Nicaragua, and they were doing all sorts of various things, such as they were mining the harbors, not the Contras, the United States was mining the harbors of Nicaragua, mining their ports so that like ships coming in would blow up. They were targeting oil reserves and blowing them up. There was the Contras were attacking health clinics and things like that, and in this whole campaign of the Reagan administration to combat Bolshevism in the Western Hemisphere, at least 30,000 people died. That's like 1% of Nicaragua's population at the time. So Nicaragua files this court or files the suit at the World Court, and the World Court actually found the United States guilty of unlawful use of force, i.e., terrorism. You know, they found them guilty of blowing up oil refineries, attacking medical services, and mining harbors. And they said that the United States should pay $17 billion in reparations to Nicaragua. And this suit, which was filed on Law Day 1984, was then after the verdict was given, Reagan, in his great respect for law, decided that the United States doesn't recognize the International Court anymore. So, and after a while, after the Sandinistas, the Marxists there, were overthrown, they used aid to pressure Nicaragua to drop the suit, and it's sort of gone away at this point. That's the United States' brilliant upholding of law. But this also wasn't just going on in Nicaragua at the time. This was the United States was funding death squads, basically right wing paramilitaries in El Salvador, in Guatemala, and the Contras who were fighting in Nicaragua were also they had stations in Honduras and Costa Rica, and. And also in 1991, they invaded the United States invaded or is it 1990? Well, whenever they invaded Panama too, and killed a couple thousand people there. So the United States, basically throughout the 80s, and I'm not sure when the invasion of Panama was, but early 80s and maybe early 90s, whenever that was having this brutal campaign against communism, against Bolshevism, against all the people who didn't support capitalist development. In the 80s, and something like 300,000 people died in Central America in the 80s as a result of this. So when Bush goes down to, I believe it was El Salvador, to have this summit a couple months ago to talk about the possibility of having CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, he talks about how Central America's come through difficult times, but now everyone's on the same page about things, and we can now have like economic growth and this sort of thing. But this sort of economic growth is only possible because of this history of military intervention. So this brutal war in the 80s, in early 90s, I guess, paved the way for this capitalist development. And in fact, the actual war itself is not over either. When the Mexican president, Vicente Fox, who's also the ex-CEO of Coca-Cola of Mexico, he has this plan right now called Plan Puebla Panama, which is a big development scheme that's going to go from all the way from Panama to Puebla, which is a state in southern Mexico. And the idea is to basically provide the infrastructure for CAFTA if that happens, or the Free Trade Area of the Americas when that happens. So they want like big deep water ports on both sides of the Central American isthmus, and they want highways running up and down so that say corporations that are taking advantage of sweatshop labor in East Asia can then ship things straight to Central America, have them go across the isthmus on high-speed trains, and then quickly up to the east coast of the United States and Europe. And if there needs, assembling needs to happen, then it can happen in maquiladoras in Central America. But the other nice thing about this Plan Puebla Panama is that it's sort of a subtle counterinsurgency program. In southern Mexico right now, or not so subtle. In southern Mexico right now, there's a number of guerrilla groups. There's the Zapatistas, who are so famous in Chiapas, whose rebellion began right the same day as NAFTA was implemented, and so that was 1994. But there's also guerrilla groups in Guerrero and in Oaxaca, in southern Mexico. And so, with the Plan Puebla Panama, it's an attack on the indigenous peasants that make up the base of support for these guerrilla groups. But it's also it also calls for increased militarization. There's something like 40,000 troops right now in Chiapas, Mexican army troops, and they want to build roads right through Chiapas. And so it's likely that there's going to be further conflict there. But okay, so I just want to talk. That was a bit of like 80s history. So I just wanted to bring that up a bit into sort of the war on terrorism today. So the G8, for example, with this being their agenda, they've made all sorts of statements supporting the national security of states and all this sort of thing, basically jumping on whatever Bush is doing at the time. And I wanted to just quote a couple of Bush and Margaret Thatcher to sort of elucidate this a bit. So Margaret Thatcher says that Islamism is the new Bolshevism. I think it's actually quite true in some ways, in that the excuse that's being used to attack people and to provide major military buildups so that the G8, the big capitalist countries, can then impose capitalist development, the excuse for that is now Islamic terrorists, and it's no longer Bolshevism. But so that's one way of sort of bringing this war on terrorism to the present. But also George Bush, I have a quote here from George Bush. This is from his speech on his new energy plan, and it explains a bit better, I think, what is meant when we're talking about all this national security concerns and all that sort of thing. He says, he's talking about how the United States is too dependent on foreign oil, especially Middle Eastern oil. He says, "This dependence is a challenge to our economic security because dependence can lead to price shocks and fuel shortages. And this dependence on foreign oil is a matter of national security. To put it bluntly, sometimes we rely upon energy sources from countries that don't particularly like us." And I think when you look at a lot of the war on terrorism, you can see this sort of national security being us relying on, the United States relying on oil in countries that don't particularly like the United States. And that's sort of a backdrop to a lot of it. So, for example, in Afghanistan, the United States never had a problem with the Islamists in Afghanistan. In fact, they were funding them when they were fighting the commies. But and then even when the Taliban took Kabul, the capital, in 1996, the various Taliban leaders flew directly to Texas to meet with oil companies to talk about building a pipeline through there. And the reason that Afghanistan itself is a strategic place is because the Caspian Sea, which is kind of north of Afghanistan, has just some of the biggest new reserves of oil and gas have just been discovered in the Caspian Sea recently, and the United States wants to sort of take advantage of that. And if the pipeline's not going to go to Russia and enrich Russia or go through Iran, which the United States doesn't like anyway, it's going to have to go through Afghanistan. But sort of after September 11th, I guess, the United States realized that this regime, was one of those ones that didn't particularly like them and was not the stable government that was necessary to build this kind of pipeline. So that's part of the backdrop for the attack on Afghanistan. But when you look at the nice list that the State Department has put out of international terrorists, there's 33 right now. There's the Al Qaeda and Afghanistan-based terrorists, and then you have a lot of say Palestine liberation groups, and I think that also you can tie right into this idea of the United States not wanting to depend on oil from countries that don't particularly like it. Because a lot of the Palestinians don't particularly like the United States for funding the Israeli occupation. And So the United States Israel's the number one recipient of aid from the United States, and Egypt's number two. And that's a lot about keeping stability in the region and keeping governments in power that do like the United States, at the expense of whatever, like whatever Israel's doing. The United States is never very critical. And then this oil. Well, first of all, the other interesting thing here in the if you look at the list of terrorists that the State Department has outlined, is that a lot of them are also from Colombia. There's the two major guerrilla groups in Colombia are also on this list, and this kind of goes right in with the United States Plan Colombia, because right where Plan Puebla Panama ends in Panama, Plan Colombia, which is now called the Andean Initiative, takes over. Because the United States is always, well, big corporations, mainly based in the United States and G8 nations, have always wanted to get a hold of the resources in this area. For example, Venezuela is the third largest importer of oil to the United States. And, you know, Venezuela and Colombia, there's a certain amount of cooperation between Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, and the FARC, the revolutionary group in Colombia. So this plan of the United States looks a lot like the United States plan in the 80s in Central America. Massive militarization of Colombia. I mean, just recently in the New York Times, there was an article saying that the United States wanted permission to directly train the Colombian army, as opposed to just give them massive amounts of aid. And Colombia is actually number three in international aid from the United States after Israel and Egypt. And that's a lot to do with oil, because the Colombian guerrillas, one of the things that they're doing is attacking the pipelines of the oil companies that are in Colombia and also Venezuela. Recently, there was a coup in Venezuela. It was a short coup. It was backed by basically the ruling classes. It was the union bureaucracy, the commercial organizations, certain people at the oil companies, the police, and the media. And they overthrew Hugo Chavez. And then after there were massive demonstrations, he was back within 48 hours. But Hugo Chavez is another one of those governments that doesn't particularly like the United States. He actually criticized the United States' war on terrorism as fighting terrorism with terrorism. But this sort of thing, and we don't have proof that the CIA was behind this, but... Well, it's kind of, for example, I have a quote here from William Bloom, who's a guy who writes about the CIA, I guess. And he says, "How do we know the CIA was behind the coup that overthrew Hugo Chavez? Same way we know that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. That's what it's always done, and there's no reason to think that tomorrow morning will be any different." But, I mean, this coup and this, because the United States never condemned the coup, of course. They were really happy about it. And right after the coup, international oil prices dropped 6.1%, which was the biggest drop in oil prices in 5 months. So the whole Andean Initiative and all this general like focus on northern South America there has a whole lot to do with oil and has a whole lot to do with clearing the way for capitalist development. I think it's important to look then how these two agenda items are like the two agenda items on the G8 are really very interrelated. The war on terrorism is the military aspect, and the economic growth is the sort of, you know, it's the economic aspect of the attack. Just I have a few quotes here to sort of show how these things are interrelated. This is a memo from Chase Manhattan, which is a big bank, I guess. And they're talking about investment in Mexico. This is from 1995, I think. Yeah, 1995, January 13th, 1995. And they're talking about how investment in Mexico has been hurt by the peso crisis and all this sort of thing. But they're also worried about the sort of thing that the rebel groups and the Zapatistas are in Chiapas are doing to investment. And they say, and in the memo it says, quote, "While Chiapas, in our opinion, does not pose a fundamental threat to Mexican political stability, it is perceived to be so by many in the investment community. the government will need to eliminate the Zapatistas to demonstrate their effective control of the national territory and of security policy. So the, I mean, that just kind of shows you how directly tied these two agenda items are. A couple more nice little quotes to show you that also. This is from Vision for 2020 from the United States Space Command. It's a nice little document. You can get it on the web. It's all about how the United States wants to basically militarize space and put you know, satellite-mounted laser things to attack the Earth and all these things. But you know, huge military budget increase. They want total control, full spectrum dominance, it's called. So that's like, you know, political, economic, technological, and military control. But one of the interesting things that they say in here, one of the interesting justifications that they give for why they want all this extra money is as following: why they want all this extra money for military, why they need more militarization. They say one of the reasons for this is because, quote, the globalization of the world economy will also continue with a widening between haves and have-nots. So you also need all this military technology to protect yourself when you're making people poor. And then I just want to end with this, well, not end, but end this agenda item with this quote here from Thomas Friedman, who's a correspondent at the New York Times. He's actually extremely in favor of U.S. imperialism, but he also sees how capitalist development and how the military are interrelated. He says, "For globalism to work, America can't be afraid to act like the almighty superpower that it is. The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the designer of the F-15. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies is called the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps." So, yeah, all of that is just sort of meant to show how these two aspects are really kind of like a 1-2 hit, making people poor, and then it's defended with military might in the last instance. Of course, the G8's not actually going to say, the G8, the rich countries, they're not actually going to say, we're going to make you poor, rob you of all your stuff, and then shoot you if you try to resist. They have all these nice sort of terms that they've come up with that sort of smooth over this whole agenda. So they're always talking about global governance and coordinating policies and achieving consensus. We in the CLAC have been calling these the fuzzy mittens on the hidden hand of the market and the iron fist of the military. That was our little soundbite. But we've also been talking about the ABCs of global governance rhetoric. So A is for, and this is the way that the G8 sort of legitimizes this whole agenda. So A is for Africa, and I've talked a bit about the African new Partnership for African Development, and they're using this whole African focus on Africa to try to show how much that they really care about poverty and all these things. B is for Bono from U2. Bono's been like the spokesperson for debt relief. He used to be sort of an activist pressuring governments for, you know, to an end to these sorts of policies that impose debt. But he's sort of been co-opted at this point, and there's all these pictures of him, hugging Tony Blair at the G8 summit last year. And because the G8, in conjunction with the IMF and the World Bank, have granted quite a bit of debt relief. But it's kind of important to see what we like mean when we say debt relief. First of all, quite often when debt relief is given, the country will already be, like, for example, in 1996, the G8 countries, as well as the IMF and World Bank, came up with this program where they were going to relieve, $100 billion in, it was $45 billion, that's what, $45 billion in debt relief. So they're going to give $45 billion in debt relief. And actually, they've only given something like a few billion of that so far. But they were going to relieve $45 billion in debt relief. the problem was that at the time, the countries that they were talking about had a debt of $207 billion. And of that 207, they were already not paying the interest on $100 billion. So you would have to give back over $107 billion in debt relief for it to make any difference whatsoever on the ground. It was basically already admitted that money was gone, and they weren't going to get the money out of it. But the idea behind this whole debt relief regime, or the whole debt relief idea, is to create a regime of debt, is to create what they call sustainable debt, so that the countries don't default on their debt, but they can keep paying debt. They can keep transferring their resources to the big corporations and to the rich countries. the other nice thing about debt relief is that here's a quote from Michel Camdessous, who was former managing director of the IMF. He says, having in mind that debt alleviation can be a powerful incentive to economic reform and economic progress, then the more countries going for economic reform and progress and benefiting from debt relief, the better for the global community. I insist on that. If we have learned one thing about debt relief, it is not so much that the amount of debt reduction matters. Of course, it matters a lot. But what matters even more is the quality and duration of the economic effort that must support the debt relief and create change for the better. This, of course, carries a message about the way in which money should be spent on debt relief. It must be in a way that creates incentives for countries to continue to persevere with adjustment and reform. And we have to be inventive for that. So a lot of times countries will get a certain amount of debt relief if and only if they agree to have their economy restructured and to continue with various neoliberal reforms. And one of the brilliant little inventive things that they've done is have Bono talking for them. And so Bono here has a great quote when he's saying, in a sort of moment of insight, he says, "I know how absurd it is to have a rock star talk about the World Health Organization or debt relief or HIV/AIDS in Africa." And it is absurd because he's Bono, but second of all, because we shouldn't even be talking about debt relief. If you add up all the money that was taken just from the Americas and put on a really small interest rate, during the colonial era, if you take the money that was taken from the Americas just in, like, say, silver and gold, directly stolen through colonialism, and then put an interest rate on it, it comes up to an amount of gold that's like something like twice the size of the planet or something. It definitely weighs more. So if there's any sort of historical debt here, it's a debt that the rich countries, these countries that have been behind colonialism and imperialism for hundreds of years, at least, if not for that, at least for the past 50 years of sort of neocolonial policies. And then the C, so Africa, Bono, and that was A and B, and then C of the global governance rhetoric was consultations and co-optations. So one of the things, at least that they've been doing in Canada, the GIA, I don't know how much they've been doing around here, is they've been having consultations with representatives from civil society. And so they go and talk to various NGOs and all this sort of thing. I mean, first of all, the problem with this is that the agenda's already set, and no matter what you say, they're not going to actually change what's going to be on the agenda at a G8 meeting. Like, if we go there and say we want reparations from the United States to Nicaragua as opposed to relieving debt, then, of course, it's not going to get on there. But second of all, it plays into this whole marginalization of a certain portion of the movement. And this marginalization comes directly from the G8, and it's I think fairly intentional. This is a quote from the G8 leaders. This is their statement on demonstrations and violence after the Genoa thing last year, where someone was killed. And they say, "We have always respected people's right to legitimate protest. We recognize and praise the role that peaceful protest and argument have played, for example, in putting issues like debt relief on the international agenda. But we also condemn firmly and absolutely the violence overflowing into anarchy of a small minority that we have seen at work here in Genoa and in recent international meetings." So this whole idea of consulting with civil society is really part of a plan to marginalize parts of the movement and to co-opt the parts of the movement that aren't asking for really radical change. And so another thing, besides the sort of consultations with NGOs. They've had consultations with protest groups. The police, the summit security for Kananaskis, have been going around, and what they do is they say, you know, you tell us what you're doing, we tell you what we're doing, and we'll both have a fun protest, and we'll both have our goals achieved. But, I mean, of course, our goals are mutually exclusive. And as, like, this just continues to play into this marginalization. When you talk about, like, talking to civil society and consulting with civil society, when there's an attack, when these attacks, when people are starving to death, when people are being shot and killed, when they're, you know, when the U.S. is mining harbors, this is not a civil attack. This is uncivil. And so when the resistance that comes back is uncivil, it's messy, it's rioting, it's fighting back, this resistance can then be can be marginalized through this process of consultation and co-optation. I think it's this kind of resistance, this messy resistance, this kind of struggle, that is really absolutely necessary if we ever want to change any of this stuff. So I think, for example, we in the CLAC take a lot of inspiration, especially from struggles in the South. Like, for example, in Bolivia in 2000, there was a company that was privatizing water there, and they were raising the price of water so that people couldn't have any more water. It just cost too much. And people rioted. People went out in the streets. They set up barricades, and they fought with the police. And people died. And it was messy. And it was a struggle. It's not like a game. But they eventually kicked out the company that wanted to privatize the water. And you can see that also in say Argentina. Argentina had been the grip of neoliberal policies for decades. And just recently, what's being called the crisis is actually Argentinian people like saying that they're not going to take this anymore. They're getting up. They're, you know, people who are starving are looting supermarkets. There's groups of unemployed workers who are blocking roads. And again, people are being killed. It's messy. It's nasty. But it's also absolutely necessary. You can see on the back of the latest Barricada a list of the martyrs from Argentina. But it's also not just in the Global South that we see this, because I have a nice quote from the G8 here. After all this rioting, 33 people were killed in Argentina, all this sort of thing. The G7 finance ministers come out with a statement saying that emerging market economies currently face mixed economic and financial market conditions. They should continue to implement policies conducive to investment and economic growth. We welcome, as steps in the right direction, recent announcements by Argentine authorities. So the G8 is again directly tied into these policies that are really they're screwing people over, not just in Argentina, but everywhere. And this resistance we don't just see in the South. We see it, for example, some people on the caravan. I'm sort of part of a caravan that's talking about this. And some people went to New York City and they met with people from a group called DRUM, Desi's Rising Up and Moving. And of course, part of the war on terrorism has been the war at home. It's been a crackdown on immigrants, and a lot of them have been sort of illegal immigrants that are the unpaid labor that the country kind of functions on, and they've been deported and totally brutalized. And people from DRUM they've been speaking out, and even people who are illegal have been speaking out at great risk to themselves. And it's the same thing that's been happening all over in Ontario, for example. The Ontario Conservative, they're called the Progressive Conservatives, who my friend from the anti-capitalist group in Ottawa calls the evil poster children of capitalism, they've been doing the same sorts of policies that you see implemented in structural adjustment programs, but they've been doing them voluntarily. Removing rent controls, cutting welfare, a Safe Streets Act, which basically criminalizes poor people and squeegee kids. They've actually cut back the 8-hour day so that now they can make you work 60 hours a week as opposed to 40. And it's this kind of like brutal attack that gets resistance that's kind of messy. Like, in, for example, a group called OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, they went to Queen's Park, which is where the Ontario legislature is, and they rioted, and they basically attacked attack the police lines. Well, they attacked the police lines after they were provoked and attacked by the police. But it's this kind of resistance that we're seeing everywhere, because the policies that are coming, they're getting crafted at sort of G8, World Economic Forum, all these sorts of things, having very similar effects all over the world. So you see rent controls are getting cut everywhere. I was just in Hartford talking there, and they were talking about how, you know, thousands of jobs have been cut and gone off to sweatshops in Mexico. Or in Providence, where I was a couple of days ago, they were talking how they have a very similar anti-aggressive panhandling bill. And in privatizations also, and they're actually having people's gas and heat shut off there also because of privatizations. And this is the sort of thing that we're fighting against in the global south, here in the north, and it's not just the sort of thing that we're fighting against now, but we've been fighting against it for hundreds of years. And, you know, the 8-hour day, when we're talking about May Day, that didn't happen in 1886. It happened sometime in like the 30s, I think. But it's been a long thing, and it's going to be a long thing that we have to continue. And I just want to end here with two quotes. One is from People's Global Action. They're a sort of a group that tries to coordinate struggles all over the world, and they say, it's from their manifesto. They say, "Capital has always been global. Its boundless drive for expansion and profit recognizes no limits. From the slave trade of earlier centuries to the imperial colonization of peoples, lands, and cultures across the globe, capitalist accumulation has always fed on the blood and tears of the people of the world. This destruction and misery has been restrained only by grassroots resistance." And then I just want to end with a quote that I think talks a bit about how we have to start thinking about this grassroots resistance. And it's a quote from Lorenzo Kemboa Irvin, who some of you might know. He's an ex-Black Panther and an anarchist organizer in, I believe, Tennessee right now. And he says, and he was this quote, he was actually talking about the people who were negotiating the free trade area of the Americas last year in Quebec City, but I think it's equally applicable to the people in the G8 that we're going to be protesting against this year. And he says, "Just think of it like these are a gang of international gangsters who are sitting down in a place to plan murders, talk about how they're going to redivide the world, talk about how they're going to fleece the peoples of the world and starve them to death. Think about it in terms of that, and you can develop a certain level of passion to fight the bastards." So thanks a lot. Thank you.